You're listening to the Diplomats Asia Geopolitics Podcast. I'm your host, Katie Putz.
And this is Ankit Panda, your co-host, recording from Washington, D.C.
I'm also still in Washington, D.C., but today we have a very special guest, Michael Hilliard, who is the Director of Defense and Security Analysis at the Oxus Society for Central Asian Affairs and host of the Red Line podcast. Thanks for joining us today, Michael.
It's an absolute pleasure to be here. It's great to finally be on a show. I've been a big fan for a long time.
Wonderful. We're happy to have you. So today, this fall, the Oxus Society released the first chapter of a larger report diving into really the nitty-gritty details of Central Asia's militaries. And the first chapter that was released focuses on Tajikistan, which, while it has the region's smallest defense budget, for reasons we're going to get into, it's especially interesting from a geopolitical standpoint. But before we get to those weeds, I really want to ask you, Michael, you know, about the motivation behind this report. Why did Oxus decide to pursue this project?
So being a journalist for years, every other theater we always work with has access to a lot of military information, where the bases are, where, how the branches work, the command structures, and except Central Asia. And for some reason, just hasn't been done for a very long time. So it was wanting to try and put a central resource together that not only had maps that we could look at and go, oh, well, that makes sense that, you know, the troops appeared here. Well, there's a base down the road. But also understanding the command structures, because as much as there is a lot of kind of Soviet hangovers here, how these guys are structured, and particularly what changes they've made since independence, are really, really interesting, telling us about the country's politics and long-term thinking. Because as anyone from defense will know, as much as politics can change day to day, defense, because usually you have to see years and years to make anything happen, gives you a really good long-term idea of where that country's going and who their friends are. So it's an angle that hadn't been looked at too much, and the more we went into it, the more of a rabbit hole it became.
All right. Well, that's excellent. This is true. I have always tried to look for resources in this kind of space, and there's not a lot of detail, but now we have detail. So I do want to talk a little bit about Tajikistan, which I mentioned has the region's smallest defense budget. It is, I believe, the region's poorest economy. It's one of the most remittance-dependent states in the entire world. You know, how does that sort of position, that economic reality, how is that reflected in sort of the military and the defense space?
The remittances is the big one. Frankly, 51% in the worst years will come from remittances for their GDP, which means that if Russia changes their visa laws, if, you know, they get locked out from other countries, that's 51% of the GDP is disappearing overnight. And that's way higher than even the second place remittances in the world. And that really doesn't give Tajikistan a lot of wiggle room to go against the Russians, because that, you know, overnight they can cause absolute economic collapse. What that does mean, though, is their economy is, you know, a little bit easier, a little bit more mobile in places. So they are trying a lot of new things, and they are reaching out to new partners. But yes, it effectively means that, you know, they are very dependent on outside donations and sources, and very dependent on the Russians still economically.
Mm-hmm. And we've seen this year how that's gotten a bit more complicated, certainly for Tajiks, but Central Asians in general in Russia. You know, I think let's stick on that Russia line. You know, Russia has a significant military presence in Tajikistan. Can you outline some of that for us?
Yeah. So Russia has effectively majority of it sits around the 201st, which is, there's a massive facility out in Dushanbe. There's also one down in Bokhtar as well that's tied with that. They've also got missiles out in the west of the country. They've got the Okhmir Space Station facility. There's some communication stuff in here as well, but most of it is concentrated around the capital. It used to be, you know, the largest deployment of Russian soldiers outside the Russian Federation. It still probably is, obviously taking away Ukraine, but it has been dwindling more and more as the war of Ukraine's got on. I did see a recent, you know, a couple more guys coming back, but it was always a sign for, you know, particularly your Ukraine analysts, that the Russians wouldn't be taking troops away from Tajikistan until things got bad. And then obviously they had to at some point. So yes, the Russians are by far the strongest outside power sitting in Tajikistan.
Also, on that note, Michael, how much would you say dynamics in this region since February 2022 and the start of the Ukraine war have affected how Central Asian states have thought about their broader military relationships with Russia? I think you identified, obviously, in the case of Tajikistan, why it might be difficult to push back. But, you know, I think across the region, Katie and I, for instance, talked about, you know, the differing reactions in some other parts of the region, such as in Kazakhstan. So how has your work kind of spoken to that, especially in the military domain?
There's two things that have happened during particularly the first, 2022, 2023 period when Russian arms were really, really difficult to get a hold of. Obviously, because Russia was putting all their arms towards the war, it meant that most of the Central Asians were kind of locked out of the market. So we saw a lot of them turn towards your Turkeys, Chinas, Indias, anywhere they could to get arms to keep themselves going. That kind of changed. Russia's now got their arms up to a point where they can start to, fill their orders. But that obviously was a big change for a couple of years. Russia also just doesn't have the money to give away as much. So effectively, we've seen China come into the market much more. Turkey is now selling a lot more drones and a lot more equipment in here. And Russian technology obviously has not proven as effective as many people thought it was. And that's where we're seeing this really interesting dynamic between, something like a tank, where frankly, there's a huge fixed cost there. Why would I buy a $10 million tank when I can just put a $50,000 modernization kit on the old one? But when it comes to buying new kit, so drones, high technology, the Central Asians are increasingly turning away from the Russians, which is a good indication that they're not particularly satisfied with what the Russians are putting out at the moment. So that's obviously been the big change since the war. There is still a lot of Russian influence that is just going to stay in the region, unfortunately. Russia offers air defense for a lot of these guys. It sells everything at a discount. Russia is still a large military base in three of these countries. And as well, there's now a bit of a problem because the Russian ruble is so low and obviously taking the local currency down with it a bit. It's become more expensive to buy arms from any other country compared to just buying more from Russia. So as the Russian economy gets worse, they almost are more dependent on buying in Russian arms, which is another kind of dynamic in the industry we're seeing at the moment.
Interesting. I want to turn to China now, because I think in the last couple of years, we've seen more Chinese engagement in that security sphere, particularly in Tajikistan. But they're not the only ones. Tajikistan has a really wide array of partners. When I went through the report, you have the European Union, you have India, you have Iran, you have the United States, who all have varying degrees of defense relationships with Tajikistan. How does Dushanbe really juggle all of these partnerships? Because some of these partners are not friends with each other.
No, and Dushanbe has been an absolute master of diplomacy to make this work. Dushanbe can be dealing with both governments out of Afghanistan, having the embassy in Horog aligned to one aligned to the Taliban, whereas the embassy in Dushanbe is aligned to the old Afghan government. They've been able to work with China in, they're building drones for the Iranians. They're also working with the Turkish. They have fairly good relations with the rest of Central Asia. Russia obviously has a large military presence. China is obviously the big growing one in the region, though. And this is probably the most interesting relationship I've found looking at, because China is, we all talk about the kind of Chinese bases that are coming in here. Most of them aren't PLA, they're actually PAP, so the People's Armed Police. Mm-hmm. But they seem to be learning. Yeah, keeping a distance, I guess, is the best way to put it. They're willing to throw money at the Tajiks, but not as many Chinese as people think. Even the big facility they have out in the middle of, right towards the eastern end of the country, at near Kizilabad, that's only like 300 people. It really doesn't have a lot of capacity to do very much. And it's more of a foothold. China is obviously getting more involved in training these guys, giving them drones, giving them lots of money, building new facilities for them. But what we've seen is a change, particularly in the last few years. If I were a betting man, I'd say it's probably because of what's going on in Gwadar and Balochistan in Pakistan, where the Chinese have fortunately hit this cycle of they put more troops on the ground to stabilize the situation, because obviously there's tensions with locals. More Chinese soldiers are attacked, which forces them to put more Chinese into the area, which forces more attacks. So the Chinese in this area seem to be sort of leaning on the Tajiks, saying, look, we'll give you any amount of money you need, as long as it's Tajiks patrolling the borders and it's Tajiks firing at people coming out of Afghanistan, than us. Because China is absolutely terrified of insurgencies or militants or extremism coming out of Afghanistan into Tajikistan. And once it's in Tajikistan, it's much easier for it than transiting to the rest of Central Asia and the west of China.
So I think I want to kind of start wrapping this up a little bit, but what about some of these other partners? So we have the United States. I think India is an interesting one because it pops up every once in a while. Can you outline some of the other sort of partners that Tajikistan has in this space?
Yeah, so Tajikistan has quite a few partners. India, it's a very small partner. India was much bigger during The War on Terror era. Effectively, Tajikistan was the way of getting into the country before you get into Afghanistan. That's starting to change today. It's really, they kind of semi have access to a runway that's been pretty dilapidated and unused for a long time, the Afghan border. Mostly it's just the Indian-Afghan friendship bridge, but we do see Tajikistan and the Indian sector used as a leverage point against Pakistan. Effectively, when tensions get high with Pakistan, they tend to talk about reopening bases in Tajikistan, mm-hmm. to put a bit of pressure on the other side. China is putting lots more civilians in as well. So a lot of their, you know, their weather stations, their monitoring stations, a lot of people will accuse saying they are also useful for monitoring all sorts of things. They're starting to put more private security companies in as well. So China is keeping its distance, beginning so it doesn't have to officially answer to this and doesn't have the loop they have in Pakistan, but is getting more and more involved in Tajikistan for security reasons.
Mm-hmm. And then, you know, just to go back to sort of the wider report, I know there are going to be additional chapters forthcoming on the other Central Asian states. So can you give our listeners a little bit of a preview? What are some of the things in that wider report that maybe surprised you or you found particularly interesting?
What I found really interesting is how much the militaries reflect political decision making, that when governments start to open up, you can watch this completely reverberate through the military and their command systems, and how important the sort of the balance between having, you know, your ground troops, your internal troops, and obviously your border troops, which are usually just aligned with security services. Watching Uzbekistan start to fall behind a little bit, and watching Kazakhstan really start to, you know, beef up their technology and beef up their strength. Watching this armed race starting to kick off between Tajikistan and Kyrgyzstan after their conflict a few years ago. And watching Turkmenistan, you know, have this really odd military that is one of the least capable for sort of advancing and doing big operations. But if you are trying to crack down on a civilian population or isolate a city or cut off the internet, it's one of the most effective units. They're all, you know, starting with fairly similar backgrounds, but obviously coming into independence, but they molded these militaries to really be an absolute reflection of where the government is, which I found absolutely fascinating.
And, you know, on that final note, I mean, you know, looking ahead, is the general assessment to basically anticipate more continuity in this part of the world when it comes to military spending and the nature of military forces? Or do you see any reason to anticipate any kind of change in how these countries choose to orient themselves?
I think more and more the five countries are looking to work together more. Turkmenistan is a little bit of an odd case on that one. But again, it's definitely inward looking for the region. What is going to change is, you know, bringing in more and more technology, drones, new weaponry, new radios, new all the good stuff. And a lot of that will not come from Russia. So that Russia is going to probably lose out and some influence as things go on. But it's going to be very slow. You know, as much as culture can change, as much as politics can change, the Russians are still very much built into the military apparatuses. They're built into the security services. That's going to be a very different kettle of fish to get over. So it's a politics going one way, military's kind of going the other way. And depending on how long the war in Ukraine goes on, will be how much ground Russia has to regain when eventually it starts to come back.
Awesome. Well, we really look forward to seeing the rest of the report when it comes up, and we appreciate your time so much. Thank you, Michael, for joining us.
No, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thanks so much for having me on. It's great to be on the other side of this now.
Yeah, I know, right? Now you're the one being interviewed. to our listeners, happy December. We'll be back soon with more. But in the meantime, leave us a review, like us, share us with your friends, and we'll be back soon.